Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn more about a first-of-its-kind collaboration between a bank and a nonprofit microlender that helps small, local businesses. And Jay Fox will talk to an optometrist about the importance of getting kids back-to-school eye exams. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, in a first-of-its-kind collaboration, ECDI and Huntington National Bank, two of the top Small Business Administration lenders in America, are coming together to stage the 2024 Great Lakes Lenders Conference starting August 6th. ECDI is the number one SBA microloan lender in the country, distributing $180 million in loans to small businesses over the past two decades, with its impact on Ohio's economy exceeding $1 billion annually. Here to talk about the conference is ECDI founder and CEO Ina Kinney and Lisa Gutierrez, the founder and owner of Dos Hermanos. Welcome to Columbus Perspective. I'd like to start with you, Ina. How did it come about that you are hosting this amazing conference in Columbus?
First of all, thank you for having us on this call. It's very important to make folks aware of the great work that we do as an organization in partnership with Small Business Administration as well as Huntington National Bank. It's very important to also note that small businesses are very critical to success of any economy, and especially in the state of Ohio. So how did we come about to host this conference? Well, let me tell you this. As the number one SBA microloan intermediary lender in the country, obviously we get noticed, and SBA district and regional directors as well as folks in Washington came to us, to ECDI, and asked us if we would host this conference. So what does that mean? Hosting a conference means putting together all the content and showing others, and we're going to have close to 500 people in attendance, how to do the work that we do. So it's a huge honor, and also in partnership with Huntington National Bank, who's the number one SBA lender for their 7A loans. It's a huge honor to have both Huntington, a hometown bank, and ECDI in Columbus, Ohio, hosting this conference.
Your organization, ECDI, and remind us what the letters stand for?
It's Economic and Community Development Institute.
Okay. Much quicker to say the initials. ECDI
exactly.
has been responsible for the success of local businesses like Harvest Pizza, Dos Hermanos Tacos, and we'll hear from Lisa in a little bit, and Lion Cubs Cookies, making me hungry just giving this list. But I think it's important, too, Ina, to talk about kind of your origin, because you started this company after you witnessed the struggles that your family went through back in the 1970s as they came here from your home country, their home country, the former Soviet Union, and helped to launch these businesses statewide. That's what you're doing now because of the struggles that you watched your family go through.
Absolutely. It's very important to note that we live in a country whose foundation is capitalism. And, you know, people come to this country from other, whether it's from former Soviet Union, whether it's from Africa, whatever countries, they come here for opportunities, not only to have freedom of religion, but also make their life be what they want it to be. So to that end, when we came here, we were the first family that came to Columbus, Ohio from former Soviet Union. And this is when it was former Soviet Union, not where it is right now. It was 74, and my father's dreams have always been to start his own businesses. And he's had quite a few businesses, but I've seen the failure and that he's gone through. And I always thought, well, what if there was something like ECDI? How can we really help small businesses succeed from the startup to expansion, you know, through the life of the journey that entrepreneurs go through? And to that end, that's one of the reasons I started ECDI. As a matter of fact, you know, if you go to college, nobody teaches you in college how to be an entrepreneur, right? It's a really hands-on-deck type of thing. So by starting ECDI, we're giving, whether they're startups or existing businesses, in essence, a chance to really succeed by teaching them, by providing them with technical assistance, by providing them with resources such as our women's business centers, such as our food-based incubators and general incubators, and most importantly, capital. So we'd like to call ourselves a one-stop shop for entrepreneurs.
It sounds like an amazing setup for entrepreneurs and small business owners and people with a dream like your dad's to own their own business. The Great Lakes Lenders Conference starts August 6th here in Columbus in conjunction with Huntington Bank. ECDI is there to help these small businesses get off the ground. Tell us a little bit, if you would, Ina, about who will be speaking and some of the different topics that are going to be covered
sure.
at your conference.
The attendees are going to be a lot of financial institutions, a lot of service providers, and many entrepreneurs. We also have folks coming in from federal government, from state and local governments, and most importantly, entrepreneurs, because, again, we're trying to show entrepreneurs the resources that are available to help them start or expand their businesses. The other important point to make here is we're going to have a lot of service providers at this conference who can learn from what ECDI has been able to accomplish in the last 20 years. You know, I like to think of ECDI as a business, and this is why we're in business of helping others. So we ourselves have been very entrepreneurial over the last 20 years to build an ecosystem throughout, not only in Columbus, but, you know, we have 7 locations throughout the state of Ohio. And to that end, us teaching other providers how to do the work that we do, it's first of a kind of conference like this where, you know, a provider is actually putting on a conference to teach others how to do the work. So, you know, this is a very important information to put out there because, again, we want to make sure there's ECDIs throughout the country and we want to make sure that entrepreneurs are able to start and expand their businesses. And with this type of help, you know, our goal is to make sure that this type of work is done everywhere.
Ina Kinney is the founder and CEO of ECDI, one of the top small business administration lenders in America, holding a conference in the coming days to help budding entrepreneurs, as well as, like Ina said, service providers understand the special needs that are existing within the ecosystem, like you mentioned, Ina, of small business. And it's so important to support these entrepreneurs on a local level. What's it like? We're going to hear from Lisa Gutierrez from Dos Hermanos here in a few minutes, but she's, of course, one of your great success stories. What's it like to see a small business like hers thriving after several years of work and after interacting with your organization?
Well, I mean, Lisa is a phenomenal success story. We have so many success stories that ECDI has been able to help businesses get to that next level. So it really warms my heart because the key to this is the entrepreneur has to be willing to listen and take the advice and take the trajectory of their growth seriously and really have plans, not only at the beginning of their journey, but throughout the journey. And that's where ECDI comes in, again, by helping them. So Lisa's an example of Lisa Gutierrez and Dos Hermanos. They came to us when they were first starting out. We immediately started helping them through training and technical assistance. We put them into one of our food-based commissaries. And shortly thereafter, we actually built another commissary just for them. So we've helped them throughout their journey with capital, with connections, with everything. And that's what we do. And so, again, this is just one of the success stories, and I'm so proud of Lisa because there's still so much more to come from her and her business. But I think it's very important to note one thing. Impact is huge throughout, you know, the state of Ohio and other states that we cover because it's all about job creation and job retention, as well as providing capital and having the financial impact in the economy. So from the job creation and job retention strategy, it's very critical to know that we have created and retained over 50,000 jobs in the last 20 years. That's a city, right? All of these jobs go back to the economy, right? They pay taxes, they provide local support for businesses, and that's important. So one thing that's really critical for, and I hope your listeners take this seriously, support small businesses. You know, we're in a position right now where everybody goes to the big, you know, stores, big restaurants, you know, chains and such. You have great small businesses in your community, and every dollar you put into the small business within your community comes back into your community tenfold. And that's the effect of small businesses within the United States. And it's very important for everybody to realize their American dream, whether they're from the United States or they're coming here from other countries.
Ina, what's the website where people can learn more about ECDI?
It's ECDI.org.
Easy to easy to remember. Ina Kinney, the founder and CEO of ECDI, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Lisa Gutierrez is the founder and owner of Dos Hermanos. You've probably enjoyed their delicious Mexican food. And as Ina just said, one of the great success stories of ECDI. Now, as a Columbus staple, which I believe it's very, very appropriate to call your restaurant, Lisa, tell us about how you got started.
Well, first, I want to say thank you for calling us a Columbus staple, because it is such an honor to be here in Columbus and doing business here in Columbus. And what a great city. And, you know, when we first got started, it was really my husband's idea. We had both always been in the hospitality industry, other restaurants, other restaurant groups. And he was very excited about sharing his family recipes here in Columbus, and all the way back to his grandma's salsa and the authentic food that we make. So one single food truck on the side of Morse Road selling tacos at $1.50 is how we started. And I'm sure that Ina shared that they came out and found us through their community outreach program. And once I heard that there were other crazy entrepreneurs like ourselves doing this, I was excited to get around them. So that's really how we started, with just one single food truck.
It's so resonant to hear you say that you kind of were found by ECDI and Ina, and like you said, the quote-unquote crazy other entrepreneurs. When you find that sort of group that makes you feel like you belong and that you haven't been out of your mind all this time thinking you could pull this off, that must have been a great feeling.
It was a great feeling. And I remember even when I came to the old Leonard location where their original food fort resides, and I remember seeing other like-minded individuals, big, brightly colored, wrapped food trucks with crazy logos, and even chefs and caterers hustling and bustling in the kitchens in and out trying to get ready for the day. And it kind of, you know, makes you feel, you know, these are your people, right? Makes you feel welcome and invited. And I, you know, really found a great niche there with other food truck operators really early on.
Lisa Gutierrez is the founder and owner of Dos Hermanos. They started, as she said, in a food truck. How many locations do you have now?
We have 4 food trucks and 1 taco cart. We have a small stall downtown in the historic North Market here in Columbus, Ohio. We also have a second stall in the North Market in Dublin, Ohio, up at Bridge Park. And then we have a 2-story full-service restaurant at Easton Town Center. Our biggest success to date, I think, is our commissary kitchen, which is nestled very close to ECDI's main campus. And we help to feed an underserved community here in one of their buildings by having access to food almost 24 hours a day. We serve until 3 a.m., but it does give this community a place to find fresh food any time of day at a reduced price point.
And that, I think, really speaks to the ecosystem of small business and community. And Ina, who earlier mentioned that it's so important to support these locally owned small businesses, because that does come back to the community. And she kind of used the example of it coming back in the way of commerce. However, for you to tell that story just now, that not only are you reaping the economic benefits of having a business here in Columbus, you're now giving back to a community in need. And I think that's so important. Lisa, what other type of work are you doing now with ECDI after 12 years of success in your small business?
You know, we look for opportunities, again, to help serve our community. So, you know, what comes top of mind for me is there's a small church that's located very close, and we are feeding children, which is amazing. And I think UCDI is helping with maybe some back-to-school supplies. So whether it's community-based, whether it's helping with corporations for their caterings and helping them celebrate their employees, and also, you know, our workforce. We have 80 employees here within two entities at Dos Hermanos. And, you know, you don't do that by yourself. You do that because of a community that supports you. You do that because of a nonprofit like ECDI that has micro-lending, that has a women's business center, that has a food court with other like-minded individuals, and just the spirit of, you know, helping others. So I love partnering with them on anything that we can, including this lenders conference this next week. We will have a booth there. So while we're exhibiting, it gives us the opportunity where we may not have the chance to exhibit and share with other people coming into Columbus and hear about the Great Lakes Lenders Conference. But that's another example, I think, of them providing opportunity for small businesses. And we'll be taking part of that as well.
The 2024 Great Lakes Lenders Conference starts August 6th here in Columbus in conjunction with locally based Huntington National Bank. What a great partnership between them and ECDI. Before we go, Lisa, what advice, after your 12 years as a small business owner here in Central Ohio, what advice do you have for a small business owner just starting out and who doesn't quite know where to start?
Absolutely. I say this frequently, and thank you for the opportunity, is to find a place like ECDI where there is a Women's Business Center and other like-minded individuals. Use the resources that they have. The classes are very affordable at times for entrepreneurs to be a part of. Get into that ecosystem that you talked about of other entrepreneurs, you know, learning together. Don't be afraid. This is the way that you win. We win together. We win as a community together. And then secondly, I feel like find a way to serve when it's the right time. When we first started Dos Hermanos, I was really just thinking about selling a taco. My husband was thinking about sharing those family recipes. And really the pandemic was the turning point when we had the opportunity to serve the neighborhood here. So at some point in your business that you start, you will find a way to serve, and I think that's the most rewarding. So look for that and embrace it when it comes. But I think, again, attending the conference and getting around lenders and getting the information is a great place to start if you are thinking about starting a business and growing your existing business.
And you can get more information at ecdi.org.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
There are 1.6 million public school students in Ohio and over 45,000 alone in the Columbus City School District. That does not include charter schools, private schools, parochial schools, and homeschool students. But up to 3 out of 4 children with vision issues aren't diagnosed at school screenings. Joining us today, Dr. Stephen Reed is the president of the American Optometric Association. Dr. Reed, first of all, thank you for being here. And second of all, why should a comprehensive eye exam be included on parents' back-to-school checklists?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And I've often said it shouldn't only be included on the checklist. It should be circled twice and highlighted because it is that essential. Children's vision is important for a couple of main categories. Number one is the obvious, and that's learning. About 80% of what a child learns is through their vision. So it's very, very important that the child have good vision, not only for the learning aspect, but for the developmental process as well. And speaking of developmental, many people don't know that when a child is born, their vision is not supposed to be 20/20. That's totally normal. But as their body grows and develops, their eyes grow and develop too. And so really this back-to-school checklist item should be a continuation of care that's already been started, because we advocate that a child receive their first examination between 6 months and a year old to make sure the developmental process is working right. So put together, that makes sure that in the beginning, the child's eyes develop properly. And then, of course, as they move forward in school, to make sure they can continue to see and learn as they should.
So what happens in a typical school screening versus a comprehensive eye exam?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a school screening, the tests that are performed is about 5% of what a comprehensive examination is. And so because of this, you are going to miss some problems. And that's very concerning, because if a child's parents get the letter that says, hey, your child, they passed their school screening, well, that gives a false sense of security. And the parent may say, well, okay, because of that, we don't need an eye exam. Everything's fine. But yet it's not, and the child continues to suffer. The child, too, many times won't complain because they don't know what normal vision is. They think everyone has trouble seeing, or they get headaches when they read and so forth. And so because the screening is limited, and because you have the risk of missing, and not only the fact that when they do fail, it's amazing that about 60% never make it to the eye doctor for a comprehensive exam. So we just advocate up front, let's do a comprehensive examination, let's cover the bases, and let's fix the problem.
So I remember my freshman year of college, I ceased to be able to clearly see the chalkboard. I've now given away my age from the seat that I had at Ohio State University. And I had to get an eye exam, and I found out that I needed glasses for distance. But imagine if I hadn't done that, how that might have affected my grades. How do undiagnosed eye problems affect children's learning?
Well, as mentioned before, you know, 80% of what they learn is through their vision. So if you can't see well, then it's obviously you're going to limit learning to some degree. The most difficult thing to really catch are those children that have, say, focusing issues, or maybe they're farsighted. So when they read, they can see, but it's uncomfortable, and they might get a headache. And so to carry that forward as to how it can affect them, not just with the learning, you know, if you don't want to read and you have an aversion to this, then, you know, you might choose to avoid that in the classroom. And some of these children are labeled as, you know, slow learners, when in fact they're just as bright as the other children. They just don't want to read. Some of them act up and they are labeled as having, you know, behavioral disorders. And if you extrapolate that out, then you can actually affect not only that child during school, but their career path and their life as well.
So when we think about today's youth, we automatically think of or have the image of the child that is glued to some kind of a screen, whether it be a mobile phone or an iPad or a computer terminal. How has the rise of screen time impacted eye health?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll tell you, it has impacted it quite a bit. The way the normal eye works, assuming that you have, you know, no farsightedness, nearsightedness, or that you're corrected, is that anything you're looking at within 20 feet, the internal eye muscle has to focus in, kind of like focusing a camera, so it focuses so that you can see clearly. And the closer something is to you, the more the muscle has to tighten up. So if you're looking at a screen, you know, all day long or most of your day, and those muscles are continually tightened up and focused, then what can happen in children especially is the brain says, okay, you want to focus here all day long. I'm going to fix it where this is where you focus. And then all of a sudden that child starts developing nearsightedness. Well, now they can see up close, but you've traded one problem for another. Matter of fact, we have seen double the incidence of myopia this decade compared to last. So it's playing quite a role on children and even adults' vision.
Let's turn our attention to urban school districts. As I said at the beginning of the program, 45,000 alone in the Columbus City School District. Are there programs available for low-income families who might balk at a comprehensive eye exam for fear of cost?
Yeah, there actually are programs, nationwide program that's called Infancy. And on this program, a doctor of optometry who participates, and many do, will give a no cost, regardless of insurance, and a free comprehensive examination to a child between 6 months and a year old. And all you have to do is the parents just call up and, well, first of all, go to the AOA website and look up the infancy providers to find one in your area, and then call that office and say, I'd like to schedule an infancy examination for my child. And there's absolutely no cost on that. I do know, too, from like working in my area, and Mississippi is very rural as well, and I'm sure you guys have this. There are many clubs that help. Like I have our local Lives Club that will help provide materials, you know, for low-income people. I know that we, just as far as optometry in general, we take an oath. We don't let money stand in the way of care. We want to make sure people are taken care of. I mean, obviously, we have to run businesses and so forth, but at the same time, you know, we're looking out for the well-being. So we can oftentimes find ways to help parents and reduce that barrier of cost.
Is there any truth to consumption of carrots improving the strength of eyes?
Well, there's some truth in that. Yes, carrots are good, but it may not be the best. And it's not really improving the strength. What it is giving your eyes the nutrients that it needs to maintain good function. There are other sources of that. Spinach happens to be real good. Kale, green leafy vegetables have a lot of the antioxidants and the nutrients that our eyes need. So, yeah, it's good. It's kind of like taking a multivitamin. You're saying, you know, hey, I'm healthy, but I'm going to take one just to kind of give my body what it's missing. And so if you're, you know, never hurts to have some carrots and to have some green leafy vegetables in your diet.
Dr. Stephen Reed is the president of the American Optometric Association, and his message is clear to Columbus parents. Take the time and get your children that comprehensive eye exam before school goes back into session at the end of August. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
After weeks of uncertainty following President Biden's shaky debate performance, he dropped out of the race. Now, Vice President Harris has garnered the support of enough Democratic delegates to win the party's nomination for president. Ohio's delegates to the Democratic National Convention helped put her over the top. The Ohio Democratic Party says the Ohio delegation decided overwhelmingly to pledge their votes to Vice President Harris. Ohio has 144 delegates whose votes will go to her. State Senator Bill DeMora of Columbus is the delegation and convention director for the Ohio Democratic Party.
I mean, she's been vice president, she's been a senator, she's been a prosecutor, she's been attorney general. I mean, she is, we've never, for the first political party, ever nominated an African-American female to be our nominee for president. I think she's already shown the excitement of younger voters, of African-American voters, to motivate them to get more involved and to turn out and vote.
Ohio Democratic Party Chair Elizabeth Walters said Vice President Harris is a proven public servant who will be a strong fighter for Ohio's workers, and we're ready to get to work to make sure that she and the rest of our Democratic ticket wins in November. The Democratic National Convention starts August 19th, but the National Democratic Party still plans to hold a virtual roll call to officially nominate their presidential candidate before the convention, and of course, that looks to be Vice President Harris. In a special session this summer, Ohio legislators passed and the governor signed a law to ensure President Biden was on the ballot in Ohio. Now, this does still apply to Harris or whoever is nominated. It does not specify Biden in the legislative language. The law moved the deadline to certify a presidential candidate in Ohio from August 7th to September 1st after the Democratic convention. In fact, it simply states that the law delays the deadline for a major political party to certify its presidential and vice presidential candidates to the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office confirmed to me that it applies to whoever the Democrats nominate. Senator DeMora says Democratic voters should feel confident they'll have a presidential candidate on the Ohio ballot.
I think if the Republicans try to find a loophole to keep the vice president off the ballot as our nominee for president, the voters will be heard.
And it may be moot. While Ohio lawmakers were having the debate about what had to be done to put Biden on the Ohio ballot is when the Democratic National Party said it would hold the virtual roll call by August 7th, which is Ohio's original deadline to certify a candidate. Joining me now to talk more about the Ohio delegation's support for Vice President Harris is State Senator Bill DeMora. Again, he is the delegation and convention director for the Ohio Democratic Party, but is not a delegate himself. Senator, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, sir, for having me here.
So let's talk a little bit about that conversation, the virtual meeting that the delegates had this week. It's described that the support was overwhelming for Vice President Harris. She was a senator.
Yes.
Tell me about that conversation. You know, how much excitement is there among the delegation for this?
I think there's a huge excitement. I think I said the other day, I am shocked how quickly she unified the party behind her. I thought we were going to drag this out to the convention and maybe have a convention like 1968, mm-hmm. But we don't. And I think it's great that she has unified everybody in the Democratic Party. I mean, President Obama and Michelle Obama endorsed her candidacy. So the Democratic Party is unified behind the vice president right now. And I think that's exciting. As I said the other day, she is motivating young people. She's motivating African-Americans. There was 100,000 white women were on a Zoom call and raised several million dollars for her. There's 100,000 white men on a call. Excitement is there for the vice president right now.
Does it surprise you at all how quickly it turned? Because we just didn't know it wasn't very long. We didn't know which direction this was going to go.
It does surprise me because obviously there were a lot of people right after the debate when the president didn't perform all that well. There were, you heard 15 names out there of candidates who potentially wanted to be their nominee. And I think it's great that the vice president just kind of took the bull by the horns, and now she's a nominee, and everybody's endorsed her. There's no, from what I understand, they had nominated petitions out to the public, all the delegates. And from what I understand, I think the only person that got nominated was the vice president.
Do you believe that President Biden ultimately made the right decision to step aside?
I mean, that's a tougher question. I love President Biden. I was with President Biden back in 1988 when I was in college. I thought he excited me the most back as a college student to be our president. And then things popped up and he had to drop out. I think Vice President Biden is the most genuine, empathetic, caring person who's ever held the White House. He and Jimmy Carter, I think, would tie for that in my mind. He did this, again, a sitting president stepped out of the race for the good of the country and the good of the party. And that just doesn't happen anymore in today's society. I mean, everybody's a me, me, me. But he did this for the good of everybody. And I'm sad to see him go because he's been a great president. He got more accomplished for the divided Congress than anybody. And he's done a lot of good things for the country. He got us through the pandemic and a recession and, put money into people's pockets. We've had an economy growing every month since he's been president. I mean, the job market continues to be on fire. He's been a great president. And I love President Biden. And I'm sorry that he's not running again. But, again, Vice President Harris is an exciting young candidate, and now the tables are turned on the Republican Party.
You mean with the age?
With the age thing, yes.
Senator Bill DeMora, thank you so much for your time and perspective today, and hopefully we'll talk to you before the convention to talk about how all of that is taking shape.
Absolutely, Doug. Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Now to the Republican side. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance came back to Middletown, Ohio, for his first rally in the Buckeye State as former President Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate. He held the hometown rally exactly 1 week after being chosen at the Republican National Convention. He used part of his speech to go after Vice President Kamala Harris.
When I see her give a speech, and she talks about the history of this country, not with appreciation, but with condemnation. And look, of course, every country, just like every family, certainly mine, has its pockmarks, right? Not everything's perfect. It's never going to be. But you, if you want to lead this country, you should feel grateful for it. You should feel a sense of gratitude. And I never hear that gratitude come through when I listen to Kamala Harris.
The senator didn't give any examples of what he was talking about there. Now, Vance graduated from Middletown High School in 2003. About 900 people packed into the auditorium. Hundreds more couldn't get in, but Vance addressed them before going inside. Once on the stage, he told his hometown crowd what Middletown means to him.
My life wasn't all that different from a lot of people who grew up in Middletown, Ohio. It was tough, but it was surrounded by loving people, and it was surrounded by something that if we don't fight is not going to be around for the next generation of kids, and that's opportunity. Middletown had opportunity, and we got to make sure it's there for the next generation.
He also criticized the Biden-Harris administration policies that he says hurt workers. He said he and Trump will support American energy production, close the border, and bring back manufacturing from China.
Your children deserve the inheritance of this country. And the inheritance of this country is that their lives will be better than their parents and their children's lives even better than that. That is the American dream that we fight for, and I will never stop fighting for that America dream.
Vance also joked that he's upset he won't get to debate Vice President Harris now that she's the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. He spoke for about 40 minutes and had another rally in Virginia later that evening.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So, if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The city of Columbus is expected to do something it hasn't done in nearly 70 years, change its zoning code. It's a huge focus because the city says it will need 200,000 new housing units in the next decade just to keep up with demand, something Mayor Andrew Ginther says it's difficult to achieve with the current zoning codes. These new codes would allow for the development of taller, mixed-use buildings. Leaders say this could help create 88,000 new homes as opposed to only 6,000 homes the way the codes are written now. Plus, developers will be able to build even taller if they designate 20 to 30% of the properties to affordable housing. With this major vote just one day away, I sat down with Mayor Andrew Ginther in his office to see what the vision is for the city's future and how leaders plan to accomplish it. I started by asking, why is this update necessary in the first place?
Absolutely critical. You know, we continue to grow. At the end of last year, we were one of the fastest growing cities in the country. And we haven't built enough housing in our community since before the Great Recession. This issue's just kind of compounded over the last 10 or 15 years. And what happens in communities is when you grow rapidly and you don't build enough housing, you have a supply crisis. You go back to Econ 101, if your supply is flat and demand continues to grow, your prices are going to go up. And so, you know, just when you look at another city similar to Columbus between 2010 and 2020, Minneapolis is one that comes to mind. Their growth in households went up 10%. Their housing went up 12%, increased by 12%. So their rents only grew by 1%. During that same period of time in Columbus, our population in number of households grew 15%, but our housing only grew at 13%. And so our rents increased by 30%. And that's an extension for home prices and everything else. So what we need as a community is to increase in the region about 200,000 housing units over the next 10 to 15 years to try to remain affordable for folks. And Zone In is the first major zoning code overhaul we've done in 70 years.
Why did it take 70 years to get to this?
Well, if you look around the country, changing zoning is very challenging, complicated, takes a certain amount of both community and political will in leadership. I mean, for most folks, their zoning impacts their home, one of the biggest investments and assets that they hold. It impacts where people work, if they're a small business owner, where you worship. I mean, the real core of neighborhood quality of life. And so we've been doing this very thoughtfully and working on this for a couple of years. And we're really proud of the proposal because this first set of changes will focus on the major corridors around town. So you think about High Street, Broad Street, you know, Parsons Avenue, Cleveland Avenue, you know, major corridors, because we know from our neighborhood plans and input from the community, that's where we can achieve the greatest density and height. And we know those are the two biggest contributors to affordability.
You mentioned the 200,000 units needed over the next decade. You know, will Columbus not only be able to keep up with the growth, but then now also make up for the shortfall?
It's critically important. That's why we get to act now. That's why I'm, you know, so passionate about this. There is a sense of urgency. This is our moment. This is our window. There are cities all over the country that have had dramatic growth in a short period of time that waited too long to act. And those are places right now that are having incredible increases in housing costs. So the people that make their communities go, you know, cops, firefighters, teachers, nurses, bus drivers, they can't afford to live in the cities and communities they're serving because there isn't enough housing and the prices are too high. So they're forced to longer commutes, further away from their kids, their neighborhoods, their schools, their places of worship. And we want to grow. Growth is coming. That's no longer up for debate or discussion. We're going to grow by a third. We want to do it in a dynamic and inclusive way. We want to do it in a way that regardless of what you do for a living, that you can afford to live in the community that you serve in.
Now, critics of the zoning proposal say Columbus is kind of taking like a Texas approach to it and catering to private interests and big developers. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I think they're faith leaders. There are affordable housing advocates. They're neighborhood and community leaders that have engaged in this process for the last several years that welcome the change. I mean, there are young people who have challenges finding housing right now, whether it's for rent or for purchase. They're young professionals with great jobs. They're still finding it very difficult.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.